history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, and there are stories just waiting to be told if we'll only take the time to ask a few questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we are educated, we're entertained. So often we are inspired by these memories from our greatest generation. And if you're fortunate enough to still have your dad around, I'm sure you did something pretty meaningful for him for Father's Day, right? But today we're going to hear about one son's determination to bring his father back to a place that holds great significance in that 94-year-old's life, a place where something he did nearly 80 years ago has allowed countless visitors to experience awe and amazement at the wonder of nature. Perhaps by the end of this program, you're going to want to visit that special spot as well. And if so, the timing is good because it's only accessible during the summer months. But I bet you never think of rounding up five football players to make a visit possible, as we're going to hear about today. My Father's Day thrill with my daughters this year was a visit to Yosemite National Park, where the legendary waterfalls are flowing fuller than anything I've ever seen. I think they need to change the name of the Mist Trail to the Fire Hose Trail, by the way. Yosemite's one of the busiest tourist attractions in the world, but not too far to the south are the not quite as well-known national parks called Sequoia and Kings Canyon, where one of the jaw-dropping attractions is a spot called Crystal Cave. Next year is going to mark the 100th anniversary of the cave's official discovery, although it very well could have been visited earlier by Native Americans. But before the Crystal Cave could become a real tourist attraction and a safe place for millions of families to visit, somebody had to make it more accessible using strategically placed dynamite to create passageways, install bathroom facilities, all kinds of things like that that visitors have probably taken for granted over the years. In 1940, a 17-year-old named Chester Chet Thomason was a major part of that important effort. He would go on to serve in the Navy, participate in some very historic moments in World War II, and even survive the sinking of his destroyer. After the war, he became an electrical contractor, moonlighting as the Electrifying Chet, the world's most astounding hypnotist. Later on, we're going to hear the memorable comment one Hollywood legend shared after witnessing Chet's show. But as colorful and fulfilling as his life has been, for many years he felt a longing to get back down inside that cave he had explored and helped shape as a teenager, a dream made possible just recently by a determined Vietnam veteran son who enlisted a junior college football team to pull off something he had tried to do on his own and come up frustratingly short. We're going to hear from that son. We'll even hear from the football players. But first, we're going to hear from this 94-year-old Navy veteran himself. Let's start early on, Chet. You're growing up in Porterville, California, in the agricultural Central Valley of California. What do you remember about your childhood there during the Great Depression?
Well, not too much. But orange groves. I grew up around orange groves. So we had Porterville.
Were you working in the orange groves, picking oranges?
No, I never did. Pick oranges. My dad had truck distributed boxes and picked them up. I had a stepbrother stack these boxes 12 high, so I'd holler out the cob drive truck down the middle of the grove, and I'd holler, two, 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 and he'd flip them off. If I said 10, he'd pick up the whole truckload.
Do you remember, as a boy, having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, I want to do this and this and this?
It's been a couple of years and some months ago. No.
Now, we're going to hear about how you ended up in the Navy, but there's something happened before the Navy that certainly ties into the most recent adventure you had. How'd you end up in the CCCs?
My stepmother, I had in that care much for me, so I had to get out of the house.
So you're 17 years old, and you go into the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Right.
They sent you up into the Sierra Nevada Mountains and Sequoia National Park?
Right.
What kind of stuff were you guys doing there?
Well, we was building walkways and roads and things like that. I don't know whether it's true or not, but they told me when I first got there an old Indian trick. Take a little bit of poison oak and chew on it. So I did. Took a little bit of poison oak and chew on it. And rub poison oak over me, and I was still immune to it.
So if we grab some poison oak right now and rub it on you, you'll have no reaction.
That's right.
What about when you chewed it? Did your tongue swell up?
Nope.
Nothing happened?
Nothing happened.
All right. You think I should try that?
It's up to you. It's your buddy.
I'm sure if you hypnotized me, you could get me to do it.
No, I never hypnotized anybody and put them in any danger of them hurting themselves. Very careful of that.
And what was the first you heard of this crystal cave they had there?
That's something that I wanted to explore myself. So I crawled down the mountain root by rock, hole, driving in the dirt to see what it was. And I found I was pretty far down.
And you made your way into the cave?
Yes. There was an Indian friend of mine called Tobin, and I found a way over the top of the... Out in front, they got a great big spider web, and you turn the spider, and you open the gate. But over the top, there's a little place that I get my thin body over the top of this place, take a string and land it, and go back there at night, explore it.
Was that scary?
It was entertaining, I thought.
Well, anyone who's visited there, the Crystal Cave at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, knows what you're talking about with the spider web gate there. That's a big, famous accoutrement. What's the story, though, about you and some other guys with the CCCs using explosives to create a new entrance or something?
Well, there was lava, solid lava. So the ranger taught me a little bit about using explosives. So I let them drill a little hole there and a little hole there and a little hole there. I put explosive in, and I had a little generator that I carried by hand. And I'd fire the generator, blow a little hole, because we had to make a restroom for the women and a restroom for the men, and keep them separate. So I'd just blow a little bit at a time without blowing the whole thing. And the ranger taught me that.
So basically, this is a natural phenomenon that's been of interest for centuries, probably, when you think about Native American inhabitants and all that. But now it's going to become a tourist attraction, and your guy's job was to make it suitable for all those people coming in.
Right. Without knocking over any of the stalagmites, stalactites.
Yeah. You think they'd let you do that today, what you guys did? And
I don't know.
How did you keep from blowing up parts of that cave that you wanted to keep intact?
We had 15-pound jackhammers and other people worked.
How long did it take you guys to finish that?
I don't know. Don't remember. It's been a couple of years and some months ago.
And it's not easy to get down to that crystal cave. I'm sure back then it wasn't easy. Did you guys have to build a road or a horse path or anything like that?
Build a horse path, and one horse fell over the bank, the real steep bank, and he just barely had a horse to. They used pack horses instead of pack mules.
Mm-hmm.
And the forestry used pack horses. One horse just barely got his hoofs on the edge, back us, and it fell down, had a rope tied around it, so it stopped the end of the rope, and I got it back up, and the packer, we called him Old Hoss, he kept running and told me one of his horses fell off the cliff, so my dynamite was on him, he was packed, so I went down and took a stick of dynamite and give it a toss out in the canyon.
Well, we're getting a picture of how dangerous this work was nearly 80 years ago with a civilian conservation corps, dangerous for people and animals alike. And we will definitely be coming back to Crystal Cave with the unique story of Chet's return. But let's talk about your time in the Navy, where you witnessed history that very few people still living saw with their own eyes, and even some history that most people have never heard of. What was it that made you want to join the Navy in 1940?
Well, I had a buddy that was in the Army. He came home, and he told me that they was loading real bullets, real bullets in them to their equipment. So I knew that there was a war coming. I didn't want to go in the Army, and I wanted a place to sleep and eat. So I decided the Navy was a place to be.
How'd you feel about them putting you on a tin can?
It was a ship, pretty big ship to me.
What was your first impression of that ship, the USS Monson?
I thought it was great.
And what was your role on the ship?
I was an electrician, mate.
So that meant you had a lot of fix-it jobs, or what?
Right.
Now, I've read the history of your ship. I've interviewed another gentleman who was on it like you were when it was sunk in Iron Bottom Sound off of Guadalcanal. But I haven't talked to anyone who was on the Monson when it was out in the Atlantic escorting the famous USS Hornet.
Well, first I knew we went down to Trinidad to negotiate for a base. So I followed the Hornet down there. We had several 5-inch cannons on that destroyer, 5-inch 38.
They make a little noise when they go off, don't they?
You better believe it.
And you guys actually fired some of those before America was in World War II, didn't you?
Right.
How did that happen? Some people might be surprised to hear that. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. We was escorting convoys over to England, and then we come back. I was stationed 2 years up in Iceland where we'd pick these convoys up and escort them across.
What about German submarines?
We sank 6 German submarines.
Before America was ever in the war?
Right.
So you were at war before our country was?
Right.
Was that scary, to be on that ship in those conditions, not knowing where a sub's going to be and when it's going to pop up?
Nope. Just part of a day's work.
Corey pulled up a photo here, something that you witnessed before Pearl Harbor, your fellow destroyer, the Kearney. This is October 17th of 1941, and what did you see? What happened to the Kearney?
We went out and picked her up while we'd been down off in New York. We were down there taking on supplies. Yeah, the ship went out ahead of us, our sister ship. We got word that she got hit and 11 people was killed with torpedo. So we all didn't catch up with her and tied her up alongside.
When you see something like that, when you see a ship just like yours that gets torpedoed and you guys need to help save it, does it occur to you that you could be next?
Yep. It's part of a job.
How did you hear about what happened at Pearl Harbor, and what did that mean to you?
Didn't mean nothing to me, because I was already playing war when Pearl Harbor happened. I was already at war.
Yeah, so while most of America, this was a jolt and a shock, and wow, how could someone attack us? You've been in those conditions for quite a while already, for months.
Right.
Well, and in the months that followed Pearl Harbor, America was looking for ways to strike back at the Japanese, and one of the most significant from a morale standpoint was the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. What do you know about that?
I was there.
That's what I thought. What do you remember? What can you tell me? Did you know what they were going to do?
No. My job was to keep the ship running.
Did you know they had B-25s aboard that ship?
Yeah, I saw them take off B-25s and just skim the water before I get up. Speed, you know, it's all across your fingers. Come on, come on, come on.
Yeah, I've talked to some guys who were on the Hornet for that, and that's what they say. They weren't sure they were going to clear the water and actually get up off that short deck of the Hornet.
Right. We was maybe a couple hundred feet to the starboard.
Was that exciting? Were there cheers going up?
Yep.
But you don't know what's going to happen on the other end of that mission.
No.
And those guys didn't either.
No.
But, of course, we do now, and the true legend of the Doolittle Raid lives on. Of the 80 Doolittle Raiders who pulled off that incredible feat 75 years ago, at the time of this program, only one remains alive. And in today's guest, Chet Thomason, we have one of the last remaining survivors of the destroyer USS Monson, which would be sunk off of Guadalcanal in November of 1942. At age 94, Chet sometimes isn't as talkative as he used to be. He has good days and bad days, of course, but we are going to try to discuss the sinking of that ship, find out what he had to endure for 14 hours in the water after the flaming hulk of that destroyer went under. It was Friday the 13th, but Chet calls it his lucky day. And of course, we'll hear about the unforgettable day he got to spend at Crystal Cave in the fulfillment of a dream he wasn't sure would ever come true. You can find photos relating to Chet and his story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days. And you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 94-year-old Chester Chet Thomason of Lemon Grove, California, originally from Porterville, California, which is a lot closer to Lemon Cove than Lemon Grove. We're going to hear about the exhilarating and emotional adventure he had this year in that part of the state. But for now, let's go back 75 years to 1942. With this young electrician's mate aboard the destroyer USS Monson. We heard how that ship engaged German U-boats in the Atlantic before America had ever entered World War II, and how it escorted the USS Hornet on the historic Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. Little did Chet know at the time that his ship's days were numbered, that it would be sunk a mere 7 months later. So we have an understanding here, Chet. Tell us where your duty station was on that ship. When General Quarters sounded, where did you have to be?
After string, I had to make sure that rudder was operating right.
And that's above deck or below deck?
Below, way below deck.
And the implication of that is if you guys get hit, tough luck for you, huh?
Yep. You better learn to swim real fast. Of course, I was a good swimmer anyhow. I could hold my breath for 3 minutes. I practiced that many times.
Did the idea of being down there bother you at all?
No. It was a station, but I prepared myself for it.
I don't want to leave anything out, but I want to make sure that we get the whole story of the day the Monson was sunk off of Guadalcanal, November 13th, 1942. What do you remember about that day?
Friday the 13th.
You're not superstitious, are you?
Might say it. Friday the 13th, I figured out my lucky day.
Well, I guess you can look at different parts of that day and say it was both lucky and unlucky.
Yep, I lived through it, so my lucky day.
Well, you guys got torpedoed.
Right.
In the middle of the night.
Right.
Where were you when that happened?
I was in my bunk.
Well, that'll wake you up.
You're right. Prepare to abandon ship. I saw a 10-foot 4x4 out there. And I told the other guys that were with me, there was three guys, because it's making for that log for that 4x4. That's what we did.
So you jumped in and you swam for the 4x4.
Right.
And you made it.
Right.
How long did you end up being in the water?
14 hours.
14 hours in the water.
Yeah. I had one shark come up to take a bite of me, and I saw his teeth. I took both feet and kicked him out in the side of the face and left me alone.
And you were all alone at that point?
Right.
So you guys are floating on this 4x4, and you see sharks in the water.
Yep.
What does that do to you? I think most people would be scared out of their minds.
Well, I had Navy shoes on, so I drew back and my both feet and I kicked him in the side of the face.
Mm-hmm. What's going through your mind for 14 hours in the water?
I don't know. Don't remember.
Did you think you were going to die?
Nope.
Why not?
I was too young and invincible. My body was invincible.
Your ship wasn't.
Well, I was.
Did you see your ship go under?
Yep, it was on fire. Burned.
You're one of the last guys left from that ship. How do you think the guys who died that night should be remembered? What should people know about who they were and the kind of guys they were?
There was somebody's son, and somebody would say, well, I had a son that died in the war.
How do you explain the fact that you weren't one of them, that you survived all of this?
I just was the lucky ones.
About 25 years ago, they found your ship at the bottom of Iron Bottom Sound.
Uh-huh.
And I bet there's some stuff that belongs to you that's still on that ship.
Typewriter.
Typewriter?
Yep.
Then your locker?
Yep.
So if they go back down to it and explore a little, you want them to bring up your typewriter?
It would be pretty good, though. I put in a chit to the Navy that they owed me for my typewriter.
What'd they say?
They still got it.
I know you can laugh about this now because you survived it, but 14 hours in the water, you've got nothing to eat, nothing to drink, right?
Right.
There's sharks going around.
Right.
As you can tell at home, some of the details of that ordeal weren't coming to the surface for Chet quite as readily as they have in the past, or when they did, they stirred up too many emotions for him to continue. But since he took the time years ago to write out an account to share with fellow Monson survivors, I can read for you a brief excerpt of that to help add to the picture of this intense experience on November 13, 1942. It was just after 3 a.m. when he spotted that 4x4 you heard him mention. We all went over the side at the same time, Chet writes, and made for the piece of wood. My Bulova watch stopped at 0313 in the water. When we were about 1/4 to 1/3 of a mile away from the ship, we could still see the big blaze and hear loud cries of pain and suffering coming from the ship. Just before daybreak, we heard a plane flying low over the water towards us. It sounded like one of ours, so I took my flashlight and flashed 3 dots, 3 dashes, 3 dots, SOS. He dipped his wings back and forth to acknowledge us and kept going. When it was daylight, 3 tall shark fins started circling. Story, Spurgeon, and Hughes didn't want any part of them. They said they would rather be blown up with the ship than eaten by sharks, so they started back for the ship. At about 10 o'clock, I caught up with a raft and whaleboat that were carrying a few of our men and some other men that I didn't know. One of them was one of our officers. He had his guts hanging out of his stomach. He could barely talk, but he told me that he had to go to the bathroom. I told him to go ahead and go. He said he couldn't with all those men around, so I took him out away from the raft about 20 feet and helped him. When he said he was through, I took him back to the raft, and he was dead within 10 or 15 minutes. At about 3 o'clock that afternoon, we were about a mile from the beach when a Higgins boat from Guadalcanal came up and asked us where we were going. We told him that we were headed for the beach. He told us that it wasn't our beach, it was the Japanese beach. So we climbed in, and he took us and some other survivors to Guadalcanal. We stayed on Guadalcanal for 13 days. There were 19 of us able-bodied men off the USS Monson out of 256. We left Guadalcanal on Thanksgiving Day. What contrast from dirty trenches to the USS Barnett, a transport with turkey, baths, bunks, and good food. There are so many twists and turns there, so many questions I'd love to ask, so many what-ifs, and I know, again, that, Chet, some of it you're just not up to getting into now, but I bet you can tell me what it felt like after 14 hours in the water to be saved from what would have been a very different future had you ended up on a Japanese beach and to be picked up by some friendly Americans?
Felt pretty good.
You had to have been exhausted by then.
Well, I didn't feel like running a 100-yard race.
No doubt. And that written account is very thorough. I have it linked at hometownheroesradio.com for anyone who would like to take the time to read it. We're going to hear soon about the most recent adventure Chet had, returning to Crystal Cave after 77 years and finding evidence of the work he had done there. But you've also lived a pretty colorful life in the interim. And in addition to working as an electrical contractor, you found another way to make your mark.
I was a hypnotherapist. I used to charge $65 for somebody to stop smoking or whatever they needed.
Did it work?
Sure. I stopped thousands of people from stopping smoking.
What's your answer for the people who think that's all made up or pretend or some kind of racket?
That's up to them. They want to spend their $65. They can believe it or not believe it by the results.
And I imagine you probably had a few famous names catch your act from time to time.
Oh, yeah. I was world renowned.
Even the Duke caught your show? John Wayne?
Yep.
What did he say, partner?
How much you charge for a show? I says $150. Too cheap, too cheap, too cheap.
His show business, I told you were worth more than that, huh?
Yep.
I could see why you'd get a kick out of that. Was there a trick that you used to do in your show that you were the most proud of, or was it kind of your signature deal?
Yes.
What's that?
Triple catalepsy. I take three, the smallest females, and stack them up three at a time, and then I'd stand in the middle of them.
Yeah, you've got a picture in your brochure right now. So you've got one woman lying across two chairs, another woman lying across two chairs opposite, and then like an H, another woman is the connector between those two.
Right.
And you're standing with both feet on top of her.
Right. Then I'd stand on top of her and I'd say, 165 pounds. Sometimes I would get a standing ovation. I'd always get a big hand.
And people thought it wasn't possible, probably, for her right. weight to sustain yours?
Right.
So what's the trick?
They're hypnotized.
So you're not going to pull back the veil for us and tell us what really happens?
I really did it.
And what can you tell me about these football players that carried you down to the cave?
They was pretty strong guys. They put me in a wheelchair. Away they go.
Pretty good ride, huh?
Right.
How'd that make you feel?
Pretty good.
What did it mean to you that your son would go to all this trouble to fly out here to find a football team to carry you down so you could see that cave one more time?
Damn important.
Pretty good Father's Day present, huh?
Right.
Well, and if Chet's description of that return to Crystal Cave left us wanting more, we have plenty of voices to fill in some of the blanks. In a bit, we're going to hear from some of the football players who carried him down there. But first, let's hear from Chet's son, Corey, who hatched this creative plan.
What was it like growing up with this guy as a dad? When did you first realize what he'd been through in the Navy?
A lot of the stories, you know, I've heard since I was hanging on his leg as a kid, you know, and the war was only 10 years back and when I was growing up, and he talks about it more now or a few years ago than he did when I was growing up because the experiences were fresher and more frightening.
But you heard, when you were a child, you heard that he survived the sinking of his ship and was in the water for 14 hours?
Yes, he was in that water and that... They got him on the beach there at Guadalcanal, and he said, I'm a sailor, and they said, this is your foxhole, and this is an M1, and stay there till somebody comes to get you. And because he was there for 14 days, he is considered a Guadalcanal survivor, and whenever the Guadalcanal survivors have a reunion, he is just about the only sailor that shows up. That herd's getting a little thin now. Took him down to a reunion for the Guadalcanal survivors few years back, and he's got this little special vest that he had made that marks his naval time, his naval time, the battles he was at, Coral Sea, etc. We had a little wheelchair that we were pushing him around, it was kind of a walker type thing, and we'd go into a restaurant or a bar in there in New Orleans, and you know, it's New Orleans, you gotta have a mint julep. Pretty soon somebody come over and say, sir, your cocktail's on that guy over there, or we go to a restaurant for a jumbo, and sir, your dinners on that guy over there, and he was quite proud of his service. It was a pretty interesting time to get together with all those survivors that went through Guadalcanal. The thing that most strikes me is, you know, he got to Guadalcanal, and they needed bodies because they were running, the Marines were not being supplied as well as they should have been, and yeah, they needed bodies to support the defense of the headquarters, and that wound up being my father's job as secondary perimeter with an M1. And remember, he took his basic training with a Springfield, so he had to learn. He knew how to work sights. He just had to learn how to operate the rest of it.
You ever sit here and think, man, if he didn't survive the sinking of his ship, 14 hours in the water, the sharks, the enemy bullets and bombs and torpedoes and everything from all that time, you would have never been born?
I would have never. Yep, that's quite true. If he'd been at the wrong place at the wrong time, there was more than half the ship was killed when it went down, more than half the sailors and officers.
What's the most incredible part of that story to you?
The most incredible part is the long time in the water. Everybody's familiar with, or should be familiar with, the Indianapolis that carried the A-bomb, and it was sunk on the way back, and it was such a secret mission, and they had to fight the sharks, etc.
Worst shark attack in recorded
history. Yes. And yeah, the Navy taught him to scuba dive somewhere along the line, because there are pictures of him in Navy gear scuba, and he later on taught my brother and I both to scuba dive. He was the president of Desert Divers, which is a Mojave Desert scuba diving team. This is back in the mid-60s, and the whole crew would wind up going to Ensenada for a diving vacation. He'd go diving with his buddies, but he'd save one dive for my brother and I, and then one dive for my brother, and one dive for me. We had some great times with that. Has he ever hypnotized a member of his family? Yes, I have been hypnotized by him many times. I can't watch one of his shows for getting hypnotized. I came through on my way to Vietnam from Germany, and this was 1970. On my 30-day leave, he instructed me over and over again on self-hypnosis, that in the event I were to be captured, I could rely on the self-hypnosis as a pain relief. Luckily, that didn't come about, but it was nice to have it in your back pocket if you needed it.
So you went over to Vietnam with the Army.
I went with Vietnam with the Army. My stepbrother went with the Navy, and he was shot down. We believe he was captured and died in captivity, because one night in the middle of the night, my stepmother, his mother, woke up and said, "Marvin's dead." And it was just a psychic aspiration, and we never, he's still POW.
They've never found him?
No.
What's his name?
Marvin Giles.
How hard was that for you?
He was graduating from high school when I was in the sixth grade, so he was off to his Navy career. I got to meet him, make him angry several times. you know how little brothers can be.
I'm a little brother, I hear you.
Yeah. But he went off to Annapolis. That had a little bit to do with kind of, sort of, maybe coaching the congressman to make that appointment. Dad met the congressman when he was doing electrical work in his office, and encouraged him. You know, you just don't get to Annapolis with straight A's. You've got to have more special talents than that.
So you're saying your dad hypnotized the congressman to get the appointment? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not admitting anything.
It's time for another break. Today's program has taken a more circuitous route than most, but I think we're getting a little sense of the heartache this family has endured, from Chet losing all those shipmates when the Monson sank to losing his stepson in Vietnam. We've also gotten just a tiny glimpse of the exhilaration Chet felt when returning to Crystal Cave here in 2017. But when we come back, we're going to hear the whole story of how that unfolded and just how big of a challenge it was. Corey Thomason will give us his side of it. Then we'll hear from a junior college football coach and two of his players who rose to the occasion to help make this dream a reality. You'll find photos of their life-changing adventure at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a story that is certainly unique. We heard how 94-year-old Navy veteran Chester Chet Thomason survived the sinking of his destroyer, the USS Monson, in November of 1942. But we also heard about his work before the war in Sequoia National Park, where he was part of a CCC crew that created new passageways in one of that park's most famous attractions, Crystal Cave. There was a desire on Mr. Thomason's part to return inside that cave for the first time since 1940. And to pull it off, his son Corey had to enlist the help of a nearby junior college football team. We continue with Corey now, himself an Army veteran who served in Vietnam. Corey, what was it that made you so determined to take a 94-year-old back down into that hard-to-reach cave?
Well, he's my dad, and let's just say that I wasn't always the best son, but when I needed him, he showed up. Well, let's just let it go for that. It worked out, and then 4 years ago, I tried to take him down to Crystal Cave, and I was early 60s. He was, you know, late 80s, and I just ran out of steam trying to get him down there and couldn't do it. To get him back up the hill, he actually grabbed onto my belt, and I pulled him up like a draft animal or something.
It so, might be more amazing that you two survived that than him surviving 14 hours in the water.
Well, this time, I said, you know, a little prior planning prevents poor performance. So I got online and went through the local colleges, and I got in touch with him and said, can I rent some football players? Because I wanted to get him down to Crystal Cave, and I knew I couldn't do it. He got back to me and said, yeah, we can do it. You know, college kids always need something to do, and coach, this being a good exercise program for him, because it's a half mile down this trail of broken asphalt and dirt. And he said, should I bring two or three football players? And I says, I'm a fan of overkill. Better bring three. Luckily, he brought five. And these were big men. I won't call them boys. They were men. And they pretty much carried Dad halfway down and halfway back up. The rest of the time, they rolled him on the broken asphalt. But when it came time to steps or whatever, they just hoist him up and carry him on there. The Park Service, Katie, Liz, they were all just super tremendous for father's participation in the Conservation Corps. Some of them remembered that I tried to take him down before, and the cave doesn't open till the 31st, except for my dad. And we got him down there, and he would reminisce about the camp for the CCC was another half mile down, so you didn't go out at night. You know, there was nothing to do. That's kind of why he wound up exploring that cave more than he should. The present person in charge of explosives for the National Park Service was quite impressed with the way his father was able to blow the passages between the caverns without disturbing the stalactites and stalagmites. One of these caverns has a groove in the ceiling where father had drilled a hole for the dynamite, and it turned from a hole into just a groove, and it's pretty flat along that groove, and the little small stalactites have started to grow. The scientists that study that sort of thing are going to be watching these small stalactites because they know when these got started, the summer of 1940. They're going to be called Chester's stalactites when anybody takes a tour.
How about that? So what you're saying is they're going to learn something about how quickly stalactites can form based on the work your dad did and that these are now growing.
Yeah, these are not, and 75 years later, they're almost a half inch long.
All right. So they got a ways to go.
They have a ways to go, but 200 years from now, when somebody takes a tour of the Crystal Cave, there'll be a mention of Chester stalactites, which I think is kind of remarkable for a 17-year-old kid.
Absolutely. Who didn't know how dangerous the work he was doing was. Could have killed himself easily.
Yeah, he learned that the different percentages of nitro in the dynamite makes it more volatile.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that was a nice surprise as part of your trip. You probably didn't expect to hear that or learn that or see that.
Oh, no.
But why was it so important? Why was this such a quest for you to get him back there now?
He's my dad. You know, it's something that we don't have a lot of time left together. So it's something he wanted some years ago and I couldn't cut it. This time I was going to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And he got down there, and he was in his glory. All the Rangers were listening to his every word and reminiscence and bent over backwards to help us and to accommodate this expedition for Dad.
Yeah, they're getting a piece of history they probably never expected to get. And maybe you can give us a taste, your understanding of what all he did there to create what we know now as the Crystal Cave and the access that we have to it.
Well, he had a couple of jobs. He was the clerk typist. He could type, which in 1940 was not particularly a masculine pastime.
Right.
So he was the clerk typist, and 52 words a minute. And this was on the old, you know, throw the key, not push the button typewriter.
Right.
And my grandfather worked for him also. He was kind of a packer. I have pictures of him packing mules.
Uh-huh.
You know, there weren't any jobs in 1940. We were still in the Depression, and Grandpa came out to work with him also. So when he wasn't in the office and they needed to have something figured out to blow it out, I guess there are several spots you can still see wires that Father laid. Now, they're inert. They're just the wires that were laid because, you know, they'd put the charge in and they'd get out of the cave.
Right.
So when there's wire on the bottom of the debris, they know it's safe. Several years ago, they did find one unexploded charge that kind of got everybody's attention. And they had somebody come check it out, and it was safe and it was continued. But you can see where they knew this cavern was here because you could crawl through that little hole to find it. But they wanted a passageway over to the side that did not disturb the cavern. And, you know, he didn't want any stalactites. His job was also to make sure that anybody, a tourist that was walking down there, didn't break the stalactites or stalagmites. So he was kind of a security guard there. And they've since welded up that little hole. He could slip through as a slinky little 17-year-old. Dad's only about 5'3". So, you know, he was a small man. The stuff he did is going to go down in maybe obscure history, that some history that it won't just be another person that passed through. He's left his mark here and there for his grandsons and great-grandsons to say, hey, I got the same name as that guy.
I imagine he left an impression on those five big strapping football players who made that dream come true for you.
This was a real job for these guys to carry because it was him and that wheelchair.
Yeah.
Wound up breaking the wheelchair, one of the handles, but they sucked it up and carried him up that hill, and I'd never been able to do that. He calls it one of the most exciting days of his life, with a good memory to it, as opposed to having a little ship sunk out from under you.
Yeah, it's definitely a better memory to hold on to. And I imagine it had to be pretty satisfying for you, too, after all these years, to see him have that experience.
Oh, yeah. We got it done. The only thing that could have made it a little better was if my brother could have made it, but his health isn't in such a way that he could not have made the trip. But I got Skip's blessing due on my brother Skipper. Oh, why is my brother Skipper? Well, his actual name is Chester Charles Thomason Jr.
Uh-huh.
His nickname is Skipper because my dad always wanted to kick the Skippers.
Anything else you think we should know about your dad?
No, he's made his mark, and I'm proud of him. I'm glad that he was able to participate in, even though he didn't know what he was doing or why he was doing, that doodle raid was, as you can imagine, the Japanese had years to plan an attack on an obscure little nowhere called Pearl Harbor, and 5 months later were bombing their capital. That must have left a real bad taste in somebody's mouth. On Mount Soledad here in San Diego is a monument to the servicemen of the various actions from World War I, etc. They don't have to have died in service. And Dad's up there with maybe 1,000 other servicemen from different services with pictures and the history. And you can see by the numerous lines there, Dad counted 182 enemy engagements. Dropping a depth charge is an enemy engagement.
But sure.
So is dodging a torpedo.
And this plaque is on that memorial, which is one of, if not my favorite place in all of San Diego. It's got to be the best view anywhere in California. You can see miles of coastline in either direction. And there is a beautiful memorial cross that stands atop that mountain. And all these plaques surround that cross, and you'll see some famous names. Glenn Miller is one of them I know who's up there. I think Ted Williams is up there. A lot of famous names. And then a lot of names like your dad's, which everybody should know. And if they go there, they'll see this plaque, and they see a photo of him in his Navy uniform. Underneath it says, "Your bravery is not forgotten." It's got the photos of his two ships, the Monson and the Stevens. When somebody goes up to Mount Soledad and they see your dad's plaque, what do you want them to think or know or understand?
That we live the way we do because of men like him that were able to step up and answer the call.
Amen. And I'm thankful we could hear a little bit of how your dad did exactly that in the Navy. I know our whole audience is thankful you could share your part of the story and your dedication to your dad here today. And it's not just the Thomason family that had an eye-opening and even life-changing experience. We're going to hear now, in succession, from Tony Caviglia, the football coach at Fresno City College, and two of his players, Jamal Pickett and Braylon Williams. First, the coach. Tony, how did this all begin for you?
We get calls for community service all the time, and I like to give some guys on my team, different guys on my team, a chance to get involved with the community. But this one was an odd one. This is not like helping kids in a reading program at an elementary school or anything like that. This guy was asking for some players to carry his father down a cliff about half a mile to an entrance of a cave. We don't get too many requests like that.
What about it made you take the time to consider it and then eventually follow through with some of your guys?
Really, the passion of his son who called. You know, I didn't realize what we were doing, to be perfectly honest with you, until we actually got up there. You know, it's a good 2-hour drive, 3-hour drive to get up to the cave entrance. And when we got up there and we saw all the Rangers, we met Thomason and his son and the guys that I brought up there, you know, they pretty much came because I asked them to come and kind of told them, but I really didn't know what I was telling them. I didn't even know there was a cave like that even existed. And just to watch them work together, the five of them as teammates, being able to take turns lifting the chair and taking different spots and, you know, working together as a unit to get that guy in his wheelchair down to the mouth of the cave. It was exciting for me to see.
Coach C, when he means business, he means business. So I knew that when he asked me about this and he said it was a veteran, I was like, you know, when I heard veteran, I was like, oh, of course. Like, you know, that's not even a question. I'll do that. So, I mean, it was an honor that he had asked me and a couple other players to have the opportunity to take that veteran down to a cave. It was something that I couldn't turn down, you know?
How hard was it? How big a deal was this to carry a wheelchair down that kind of grade, that kind of slope, to where you guys could actually get in the cave with him?
It was extremely hard. I mean, I was not expecting, like you said earlier, when Coach C asked about carrying a man in a wheelchair down to a cave. Like, you know, we were just like, oh, yeah, football players, we got this. This is all, it's easy. But, I mean, it was extremely hard. I mean, there was times where we couldn't even push. We had to all pick a side of the wheelchair and lift the man up to get through some of the areas. And some of these areas were extremely tight. We had him lifted up with one arm and then, because we had to adjust our bodies in order to turn him at some points. You know, when we got to the cave, I kept thinking, how are we going to bring him back up the mountain, pretty much. You know, I was like, but it turned out to be a lot easier bringing him back up than bringing him down due to the force, you know, because we were, you know, worried about the wheelchair tipping forward at some parts. But, you know, carrying him up the mountain was a lot easier than bringing him down.
You play running back, right?
Yes, sir.
And we all know there's one thing a running back can never do. You can never fumble the football. I mean, have you ever felt as much pressure carrying the football as you did carrying a 94-year-old man in a wheelchair?
No, I didn't. It didn't match up to football. I mean, I've been in some games where, you know, it's important to not lose the ball. But, you know, with him in a wheelchair and what he's done for this country and what he's done for that cave, it was something that, like, you know, we had to make sure we got him there safely. And we were going to make it happen. There was a lot of pressure. It was. But, you know, we didn't crack. You know what I'm saying? We held it together and got him to the cave. And even when we got to the cave, we helped push him all around the cave because there were some parts in the cave that was extremely tight. We had to, you know, lift them up. So, I mean, it didn't just stop. The work didn't stop when we got to the cave. We had to help them all through the cave as well. But at the same time, we weren't even thinking about the help. It was an experience that all of us got, and it was just a blessing to be a part of it. What I took from it all was, like, chase my dreams and be somebody and leave a legacy behind, because he definitely left a legacy behind. The things that he's done in life, it's crazy. To see him still going and smiling, it's a blessing, you know. So I just want to. He's a hero to me. He's a hero to everybody. So it was something that, like, I want to be like that, you know. I want to leave behind a legacy and people to know my name and remember that good things that I've done in life.
And finally, Braylon Williams.
We first tried to just wheelchair him down, and then, like, when it got difficult going downhill, we put on extra straps, and just carrying him down, all five of us helped out, and it was just extraordinary. It was just a great experience.
Was it hard, like physically hard to do?
Yes, it was. It wasn't easy. It was challenging, but it all paid off in the end. I saw Chester's marks where he laid the bombs and also all the new formings of the Crystal Cave. It was just great. It was amazing.
Had you ever been in there before?
No, I haven't. First time.
Did you even know it was there?
No idea.
Can you imagine a guy about your age or even younger than you, I guess, when he did it, crawling around there and sticking dynamite in places and setting it off?
I can't imagine it. It takes extreme bravery for that. And Chester, he's a great man, and just thank him for all that.
Did you get a sense of what it meant for him to be back down there and what you guys did for him to get him down there?
Yes, it was extremely emotional. We knew, like, and he knew, like, this is his last time seeing it. And so we just wanted to make that moment special for him, and he was just a great, nice guy.
Members of our latest generation honoring the greatest generation in a unique and powerful way. Haven't heard a story quite like that before. Thanks again to Chet and Corey Thomason and to the Fresno City College Rams football program. We're out of time for today, but don't forget to check out those photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Until next time, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.